Well, hi everybody. We're on program number 80 in the externalization of the hierarchy. And we've been talking about how the new group of world servers is to treat the obstacles that they find in their way. And the facts on which they are to take their stand, the facts. Okay, let's see if I can get this the way it should be. So many things in the foreground seem to militate against a clear understanding of the value of even horrible things which have passed. But the world servers have to look at the great war as the broom of the Father of all, sweeping away obstructions in the path of his returning son, which is the love aspect. So he tells us it would have been well nigh impossible to prepare for the coming, the second coming, the reappearance of the Christ and his hierarchy, in the face of the pre-war conditions. And he said that with regard to the First World War, and he also means it with regard to the Second World War and with regard to the entire First and Second War together, considered as the Great War, 1914 to 1945. Upon these facts, the new group of world servers must today take their stand. They must recognize the obstructing factors, but must also refuse to be frustrated by them, because frustration can so easily end in futility and in non-accomplishment, and that would be just a repeat of the kind of thing which occurred before the Second World War, and which if done properly, could have prevented the precipitation on the outer plane of the Second World War. We can't let that happen again. They, the new group, must be aware of the hindrances, many of them financial and based on material greed, which is based on the thought of what one must have and possess, even though it does one no good in terms of spiritual evolution and the true state, desirable state of the psyche, and then employ such skill in action and such business acumen that these hindrances will be overcome. Well, with the coming in of the first degree, seventh ray disciples, these inequalities, these great separations between the rich and the poor, financially considered, will move towards solution. This is advice for us, isn't it? They must walk clear-eyed through world difficulties, and holding his, the Christ's, five-pointed star before them, the star of the solar angel, upright, pass unscathed and successful through the midst of all frustrating factors. Well, is that a charge to us and a piece of electrified advice telling us how we have to consider the usual frustrations that might make us say, well, what can I do? And just let it pass. No, we can't do that. So going on program 80, he says, I seek not here to deal with the usual spiritual frustrations or wish to waste time with the ordinary platitudes and the well understood replies which do not aid because they remain platitudes and are not translated into action. I mean, a platitude may be a truth, but if not translated into action, it just is stored in the mind with karmic consequences and does no good, really. It doesn't better the situation of the individual, and it doesn't better the situation of those the individual seeks to help or the group seeks to help. So we have to avoid platitudes upon which we take no action. I shall deal here, he says, with only two factors which condition the present opportunity. These can be regarded as so completely hindering that unless they are removed, there will be a long delay before the Christ can return. And, you know, think of it. In some of his earlier books, it looked like the 20th century would see the Christ returning. But no, the humanity was not ready, and humanity was in danger through the release of atomic energy, which they could not be trusted to handle harmlessly. So what are these two factors? First, the inertia of the average aspirant or spiritually minded man. Second, the lack of money for the work of preparation. So here, these are the issues. They are completely hindering. And do they still exist today? I would have to say yes. And the inertia. We may know a lot that we've been taught, or at least hold it in our minds, and just can't get ourselves to move. Both of these, no, that's not what I intended, I'm sorry. Both these hindrances are fundamentally based on one and the same thing, materialism, which is, of course, mistaken perception and mistaken self-perception. One is deluded by the apparency of things, by the form, nature, and doesn't think about the energy content of that form, or the fact that the form can be reduced to or etherealized into energy. There the Einsteinian formula helps us a lot. E equals mc squared. And one can even go beyond that when dealing with the higher planes, where the question remains, what about the speed of light? Is it really a limitation when we're dealing with the astral and mental plane, or when we're dealing even more with non-locality or ubiquity, with everywhere at the same timeness, as it were? Materialism, one on the materialism of physical effort, and the other on that of a world attitude. one on the materialism of a physical effort. I suppose that's the first one, and then the other on that of a worldwide attitude. We can't seem to deflect the needed resources into the proper channels because of the prevailing attitude of that symbol we call money. And we are fixated upon it in terms of its material possibilities, but not in terms of its spiritual evolutionary possibilities. So let us keep these themes simple, he says, and down on the level at which most people work and think today. Let us be intensely practical and force ourselves to look at conditions as they are, because we oftentimes seek to avoid that unpleasant gaze, thus arriving at a better knowledge of ourselves and of our motives. Okay, let's keep it simple, he tells us. So there can be no evasion or alibis based upon the old refrain, I don't understand, or I didn't understand, or I didn't realize that that's what you were saying. So we start with the inertia of the average spiritually minded man. One may know what is right and yet just not do it. The average aspirant, man of goodwill, or disciple is constantly aware of the challenge of the times and the opportunity which spiritual events may offer. The desire to do good and to accomplish spiritual ends is ceaselessly gnawing away within his consciousness. No one who loves his fellow men, who has a dream of seeing the kingdom of God materialize on earth, or who is conscious of the awakening of the masses, slow though it may be to the higher spiritual values, but is thoroughly dissatisfied. He realizes that what he contributes to help to these desirable, what he contributes of help to these desirable objectives is little indeed. He knows that his spiritual life is a side issue. It is something which he keeps carefully to himself and which he is frequently afraid to mention to his nearest and his dearest. He tries to dovetail his spiritual efforts into his ordinary outer life, struggling to find time and opportunity for it in a gentle, futile, and innocuous manner. He finds himself helpless before the task of organizing and rearranging his affairs so that the spiritual way of living may dominate. I think DK is nailing it, don't you? He searches for alibis for himself and eventually rationalizes himself so successfully that he ends by deciding that he is doing the best he can under the circumstances. Well, you know, every once in a while we have to clear-eyed look at what we're really doing. And DK, who is so eager that we utilize our abilities to really uplift humanity, just has to call it as it is. And maybe we squirm a bit as we hear this indictment, this statement regarding our guilt in these matters, our failure in these matters. Yes, we're disturbed, but we just don't manage to find the time and in which the necessary effort can be made. The truth is that he is doing so little that probably 1 hour out of the 24, or perhaps two, would cover the time given to the Master's work. And yet, you know, we learn from Master M, it is a joy to do the Master's work. He hides behind the alibi that his home obligations prevent his doing more, and he does not realize that, given tact and loving understanding, his home environment can and must be the field in which he triumphs. And this, of course, is not just he, this is his women disciples as well, of which I think there were maybe a majority. He forgets that there is no circumstance, there exists no circumstances in which the spirit of man can be defeated, or in which the aspirant cannot meditate, think, talk, and prepare the way for the coming of the Christ, provided he cares enough and knows the meaning of sacrifice and silence. As one can complicate one's environment through wrong speech and thus eliminate even more of the hours that could be given to the work. Circumstances and environment offer no true obstacle to the spiritual life. So more truth coming from the Master, and we've just got to face that even now, after so much development of consciousness, every one of us can find something here that is holding him or her back from giving the best, doing the best, possible. Maybe not even 1 hour or two a day might be given. And yet the Masters are thoroughly involved every hour of the day, or whatever they are experiencing in the plane in which they habitually focus their consciousness. Hiding behind the alibi, making excuses. Well, it's not the way of the disciple, is it, to make such excuses, although we all know we do it. And this factor of tact is so important because we're usually dealing with other people in our environment who may wittingly or unwittingly present obstacles to us in when we attempt to do our work on behalf of the divine plan. So tact and loving understanding have to make it possible to make the home the seat of triumph rather than provoke antagonism, resistance, non-support. Many people may complain that their spouse or the people they live with do not support what they are trying to do for the work, but given tact and loving understanding, they would support. And what are the things that we can do? Well, we can meditate, we can think, we can talk, we can prepare the way for the coming of the Christ, provided we know the meaning of sacrifice. Let every person determine what that might mean in his or her own life, and silence, so as not to provoke the friction which eats up time and prevents the expression of action which is given to the expression of the divine plan. Perhaps he hides behind the alibi of poor health, and frequently behind that of imaginary ills. He gives so much time to the care of himself that the hours which could be given to the master's work are directly and seriously curtailed. He is so preoccupied with feeling tired or tending a cold or with fancied heart difficulties. I think that's probably very common among the secondary types who find the heart a center of tension and often difficulty, that his body consciousness steadily develops until it eventually dominates his life, and then it is too late to do anything. Ah, what truth and what an indictment. But let's just face it, that's how it is. So often, just think of the hours that could be liberated. And the factor of courage does not mean that sacrifice and silence cannot be used. Courage is needed, and the application of the will. To forego peace, to forfeit rest, you know, how often I have said to myself, oh, I'm too tired to do this program. Sometimes I have relented. Other times I said, well, I may be tired, but I will do it anyway. And then it's either bad or it's okay. And the words of Master DK have proved inspiring, and I've forgotten my tiredness in the duties that must be carried out. But he is talking to his disciples, and we should number ourselves among his disciples, or at least among aspirants to discipleship. So it's too late to do anything. Well, that's a crying shame, isn't it? I mean, a shame over which one cries later when one realizes what one has done. This is particularly the case with people who have reached their 50th year and over, the good old Chiron return. The trouble then is predominantly with women. It is an alibi which it is hard not to use. For many feel tired and ailing, and this, as the years go by, is apt to get worse. The only cure for the creeping inertia is to ignore the body and take your joy in the livingness of service, you know, because joy is going to be a great stimulant. It's not just that you're happy. I mean, the whole energy, the whole body and energy system is filled with the energy of joy. Maybe it's not easy. I don't find it easy, you know. But, okay, we're given the advice here. The only cure for the creeping inertia is to ignore the body and take your joy in the livingness of service. This leads to a longer life. I speak not here of definite disease or of serious physical liabilities. To these right care and attention must be duly given. I speak to the thousands of ailing men and women who are preoccupied with taking care of themselves and so waste hours of the time which could be given to the service of humanity. I ask those who are seeking to tread the path of discipleship to release those many hours spent in needless self-care into the service of the hierarchy. Needless self-care. To forego peace, to forfeit rest, and in the stress of pain, to lose myself and find myself, thus entering into peace. To all this I most solemnly pledge myself, invoking my higher self. When we go into the arcane school, the very first thing practically that we do is learn that mantra. To look above, to help below, to dream not, nor to rest. It's got a lot of sixth ray in it, but it's got a lot of the uncompromising attitude that would release those hours into the service of the plan, and then the service of those whom the plan serves, and then the service of those who serve the plan. One has to go against one's feelings of inertia. It's hard at times. Over 50 years, Chiron return, vitality is on the wane, but we gain our vitality from the plane of mind. It has a direct connection with the etheric body. And it's hard not to use it. Maybe one needs an anti-alibi coach, you know. Then it's hard not to fight one's anti-alibi coach. Well, I want to make this big. The only cure for the creeping inertia is to take your joy in the livingness of service. What sound advice. And, you know, at the moment we need it. Will our memory serve to bring such statements before our consciousness so we can at least try? And I know in saying this, I'm going to be challenged this very day to do exactly this. That's often the way it is. So one has to be practical. There are diseases that need tending. Where there's an ill, there's a pill. I'm sure we, at a certain age, have certain pills and medicines to take, but it doesn't have to take forever, does it? And we need have no self-pity about it. It's just the way of the body, made of the substance of the previous solar system. Once a certain age is reached, there is that tendency, unless it is countered by a great inflow of energy. As long as we're talking about alibis here. So, you know, let's just think about it. Talking about alibis. Maybe it's a word that's not so much used at this time as it was in Alice Bailey's day. Still another alibi leading to inertia is the fear people have of speaking about the things of the kingdom of God to others. They are afraid of being rebuffed or of being thought peculiar or of intruding. They therefore preserve silence, lose opportunity, and never discover how ready people are for the discussion of realities, for the comfort and hope which the thought of Christ's return can bring, and for the sharing of spiritual light. This is essentially a form of spiritual cowardice, but it is so widespread that it is responsible for the loss of millions of hours of world service. This doesn't mean that you have to fall victim to the glamour of interference. I've told that story about closing my eyes as I waited for the doctor in the doctor's office and finding myself poked repeatedly by a very zealous young woman who condemned me with the words, "You're meditating, aren't you?" "Yes, I saw you. You're meditating." "Oh, what a sin." You know, so the glamour of interference based on the sixth ray, but with tact, with understanding, with moral courage, and with the avoidance of spiritual cowardice, we can speak of these things. Sometimes you know when a person's ready and you know from their initial response. You also have to balance that with, you know, the old adage, don't cast your pearls before swine, not calling the people swine, but, you know, it makes the point, doesn't it? Because they will tromp on them and rend them underfoot, you know, and they'll throw them back at you. You might still persist. I had a relative, a dear relative, and when I would bring these things forward, I got the return statement. I love you, Michael, but I don't like you. Okay. Which means, of course, that I'm not like you in my values. So this fear has to be overcome. And I remember there was this man, RVB. He was Alice Bailey's secretary, and his ray chart was 2, 4, 4, 2 or 6, and then 3, I think. But the 2, 4, 4 was important because he wanted the harmony. So, you know, but he saw there was a lack of money, and he had to do something. And he was loath to bring it up. It's tough to talk about money and ask and expect money from people, but there are ways to do it. And he overcame his fear and did speak of these things, and the Tibetan, seeing the effort that was behind that discussion, or those discussions, commended him on that. I guess it's harder for the second-ray types to talk about the need for money, but, you know, there has been progress in that. I always admire those people who can speak about the need for resources and do so in a way that doesn't make them uncomfortable and doesn't make anybody else uncomfortable either, but in fact inspires. So we have to learn how to do that too, because it's a big block, this question of money, the crux of the problem, says DK sometimes. There are, brother of mine, other alibis, but the three above noted are the most common. Inertia, fear, not wanting to disturb, avoiding the discomfort. So just, you know, we will read these repeatedly and try to avoid being the victim of them so that we can be part of that general release of hours and hours on behalf of the work. And we just have to take the slings and arrows that may come to us. Okay? They will come, and they will come increasingly. I don't think that the high priests liked very much Jesus or Christ through him talking about the kingdom of heaven and healing on the Sabbath and all the rest. And plus, he was successful, which put them in a bad light. But, so what do you do with such a person? Well, you kill them, you know, get them out of the way. But he did that. So there are, I mean by that, he, you know, despite the danger and the disapproval of those in power, he spoke his truth. They have a phrase these days about speaking truth to power. You might be annihilated by the power, but you speak the truth. There are, brother of mine, other alibis, but the three noted are the most common. The release of the majority of aspirants from these hindering conditions would bring to the service of the Christ, to use the language of the labor unions, so many man hours, or these days person hours, people hours, worker hours, and so much overtime endeavor, that the task of those who admit no alibis would be greatly likened, and the coming of Christ would be much nearer than it is today. So let's not hide from ourselves that we may indeed be part of the problem, basically through spiritual cowardice, not wanting to enter that zone of discomfort, which often does arise when you bring these matters up. What we call inertia is not simply psychological in nature, the Tibetan says. The qualities of matter or substance itself are involved. Well, you know, coming from an earlier solar system and so forth, and from moonchain tendencies, inertia is the slowest and the lowest aspect of material substance and is called, in the Eastern philosophy, the quality of tamas, tamas rajas sattva, right? It has to be transmuted into a higher quality, that of activity, or giving it its technical term, its rajasic quality. And this leads later on to the highest quality of rhythm or sattva. To the rhythm of life under which the Christ and the spiritual hierarchy operate, and which vibrates in harmony with human need and hierarchical response, I call you not. I sometimes lose my way here, you know. I do, however, call you to demonstrate the quality of activity and to refuse to hide behind alibis. It is essential that all aspirants recognize that in the place where they are now, among the people who are their karmic associates and with the psychological and physical equipment with which they are endowed, they can and must work. I shall not labor the subject. There is no coercion or undue pressure exerted in the service of the hierarchy. The situation is clear and simple. There are, in the present time, three great activities going on. So, okay, he calls us not to the kind of sattva, which the hierarchy demonstrates. Okay. Because he knows, as Master Moria says, you don't put the load of a camel on a donkey. That always stuck in my mind, you know. Quite riveting thought. And then that thought that even a donkey can carry a library on his back. That's another riveting thought that has captured my attention. I do, however, call you to demonstrate the quality of activity and to refuse to hide behind alibis. Yeah. Well, I think he makes his point, don't you? And of course, we simply have to see where alibis show up in our life. Oh, I can't do that because... And I think we will find ourselves using them more frequently than we might imagine. So, where we are, in the place where we are, we'd like to be somewhere else, and then I could really serve, you know, as the old saying goes, oh, if I were only somewhere else, I could really serve. How can one serve where I am? Well, that in itself is a great alibi. So there are at the present time, three great activities going on. So let's see what he considers these to be. First, the activity to be felt in the center where the will of God is known, that will to good, which has carried all creation on towards a greater glory and a steadily deepening intelligent responsiveness. This is today, or this today is creatively endeavoring to bring the new world order. You know, it's got a lot of Aries in it, the will to create. The order of the kingdom of God under the physical supervision of the Christ. This might be regarded as the externalization of the spiritual hierarchy of our planet. Of this, the return of the Christ to visible activity will be the sign and the symbol. So this is Shambhala, and Shambhala as it inspires hierarchy. So to bring the order of the kingdom of God to earth under the physical supervision of the Christ. So first, the activity to be felt in the center where the will of God is known, the will to good, carrying all on to greater glory. There's something about Shambhala and its sea of fire that leads to a glory which outshines anything we might call the glory of the Transfiguration. So that's going on. Secondly, the critical activity which is conditioning the spiritual hierarchy from the Christ himself down to the lowest aspirant to be found on the periphery of that center where the love of God has full play, sweeping throughout hierarchy. This is fully realized. There it is. In that center, fully realized that, in the words of St. Paul, the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. Well, he knew. You know, he was a high initiate, and I'm pretty sure that he took the fourth initiation in that life. It is for that manifestation that they now prepare, these sons of God who are the sons of men. For it is this coming forth to outer activity that they are already one by one. It is for this coming forth that they are already, one by one, entering into outer activity upon the physical plane. They are not recognized for what they are, but they go about the Father's business, you know, the Christ or Jesus saying in the temple, "Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" He basically is repudiating the call of matter expressed through the demand of his mother, who probably said, "Come on home, you know, you don't need to be talking to these elders in the temple," where he was discovered teaching them, of all things. They are not recognized for what they are. They go about the Father's business, demonstrating goodwill, seeking to enlarge the horizon of humanity, and thus prepare the way for the one they serve, the Christ, the master of all masters and the teacher alike of angels and of men. So this is the hierarchical activity, the second activity in terms of what's going on. Now, DK is always using the model of Shambhala, hierarchy, and humanity. And this is, of course, the important statement said by the initiate Paul. there's a critical activity conditioning the spiritual hierarchy from the highest to the lowest. And we're all part of that because, you know, we are at least aspirants, aren't we? We at least aspire toward participating in this great enterprise, so necessitous, so utterly needed. So that's the second activity. And the masters are coming out and people don't recognize them. And they go about the Father's business, serving their master, the Christ, and serving basically Shambhala and its leader, Sanat Kumara, preparing the way. There's so many different ways to prepare the way according to one's abilities and contacts and the karmic circles in which one finds what's oneself situated. I remember, you know, I was changing from my fourth ray personality to the second ray soul, and I was an opera director. Well, it's very fourth ray, you know, and the job there is quite different from instructing on the ageless wisdom. But okay, I had to overlap, and I think I disturbed a lot of people with my overlaps as I deviated from the fourth ray and somehow interfused the teaching in what I had to say. Maybe it wasn't welcome because so many people there just were there to sing and have a good time and, you know, produce something expressive. But for me, the transition was necessary, and I don't know if I use skill in action or not. Sometimes not. Until, you know, I could finally be free of the personality call, and maybe had fulfilled the karma involved with that, and then could be completely involved in the teaching and spreading of the ageless wisdom without that uncomfortable mixture that sometimes can occur when personality incentives and soul incentives are brought together but not really balanced. And thirdly, in terms of the third activity, there is humanity itself, the center which we call the race of men. You know, he's somehow quoting here from the invocation, which had been released, the great invocation, a center full of chaos, turmoil, and confusion, a humanity full of pain, bewilderment, disturbance, yet mentally aware of infinite possibilities, emotionally fighting for that plan which seems to them to be the best, but with no sense of coherency or any realization that it must be the one world for the one humanity. They simply desire emotional peace. Now, that kind of peace is not the peace we are striving for, really, is it? That sort of peace at any price thing that can happen with the fourth ray. They desire simply emotional peace, security in which to live and work, it's understandable, and a vision of the future which will satisfy some inchoate sense of divine persistence. Well, that is what most people are desiring, and any politician has kind of got to know that. They are physically ill, deprived for the most part of the essentials of normal, wholesome living, racked with the sense of financial insecurity. We've seen that in this epidemic where people have lost their jobs in the millions because of the shutdowns to prevent millions more from contacting or contracting the disease. Racked with the sense of financial insecurity and consciously or unconsciously invoking the Father of all on behalf of themselves and of the rest of the world. Oh, always when humanity is described frequently, a kind of sadness comes over one, but at the same time, this is the foreground. And we as disciples and aspirants have to walk clear-eyed through the distressing scenes immediately ahead of us, holding in mind that which is on its way, being confidently convinced that these things are coming, these better ways. And through our own confidence and radiation, giving courage to others. Sometimes, you know, as an astrologer, I've thought about all the things you can say to people, but the ultimate thing here is that they should leave the session with a sense of positivity, confidence, new energy, the will to move forward to the fulfillment of their destiny. The positivity is the main thing, in my view, which doesn't mean you don't, you know, do the best as you can, provide the specific astrological information. But if you just provide astrological information without the positivity, you haven't done your job. The solution is the return of the Christ. This is the ascertained will of God, our planetary logos. It is the desire of Christ himself and of his disciples, the masters of the wisdom. You know, here we go. This is the, he's charging us. He's giving us the charge, which electrifies us. It is the unrealized demand of men in all lands, where there is unification of purpose, of spiritual intention, and of realized need, then there is only one thing which can arrest that return, and that is the failure of mankind to prepare the stage for that stupendous event, to clear the highways, familiarize the people with the idea, and bring about the required message or measure, bring about the required measure of peace on earth, a peace based on right human relations. Well, his summaries are brilliant and memorable, and they are not few. So that may be the only thing that militates against remembering some of the best ones. They are existing, but at least to know where to go to reread and rethink. You know, what have we been dealing with here? Makes me want to kind of, yeah, well, this inertia and the second thing, the lack of money, you know. I'd like to see where this all really begins. Well, I can't waste our time right now looking. It just tells me I have to, you know, revisit all the many things read here and focus in this essay on the preparation for the reappearance of the Christ. But anyway, those two things are standing out, the inertia and the lack of money. The things that are in the way. He's being very clear with us about what's in the way. And as a result, we are gaining a clearer idea of how we can help and what we can do. In any case, point number two is where we are. And I think that's what we have to deal with right now. Yeah, well, he's dealing with these two points. The first point was inertia. And the second point was the lack of money. For the crux of the problem, as he often states, the lack of money for the work of preparation, which is immediate indictment of our sense of values. How do we spend our money? On what? Does fear keep us spending it in a way that is outside the channel of real spiritual use, with its possibility of spiritual evolutionary progress? Is it fear? What is it that keeps us diverting money into the wrong channels? So let's go on. We come now to the second of the major hindrances, the lack of financial support for the Christ workers and disciples in all lands as they endeavor to release spiritual energy and bring a new order out of the present chaos. This is perhaps the major difficulty, and it appears at times an insuperable one. It involves the problem of true financial trusteeship and the deflection of adequate sums of money into channels which will definitely aid the work of preparation for the return of the Christ. It is for this reason that I closed the previous section of this article with the words right human relations. Now, this is, you know, always the tough one because money has been relegated in the minds of so many to something that is not spiritual. And we have to overcome our conditioning in that respect. The problem is therefore a peculiarly hard one, for the spiritual workers of the world have not only to train people to give according to the need and their means, but in many cases, they have first of all to provide them with a motive so magnetic in its appeal that they must perforce give. They have also to provide the trust, foundation, and organization through which the money given may be administered. This presents them with a most impressively difficult task, and one which is responsible for the present impasse. The impasse is not, however, based only on the novelty of raising funds for the preparation for the return of the Christ, but it is also based on the trained selfishness of the majority of those who own the world's wealth, and who, even if they gave, do so because it fosters prestige or indicates financial success. It's all ego, isn't it, in the lower sense? And it might be remembered that every generalization presupposes exceptions. So let it not be said that DK is tarring with the same brush or indicting all, as there are people who are, you know, very generous. And heirs to the largesse, which they either deserve karmically or which has come to them through their parents or relatives or their position in birth, you know. It's a tough issue, and we need a big change in our attitude towards the money. So we're going to simplify this subject. You know, you'll probably recognize that some of these writings serve as a preamble to the so-called money meditation that we find in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. So let's go on here. Generalizing and therefore oversimplifying the subject, we can assume that money finds its way into four main channels of expenditures. Okay. This is all pretty much in the green area, you know, but I'll use this as an alert. And number one, into the myriad homes of the world in the form of wages, salaries, or inherited wealth, all this is at present most unevenly balanced, producing extreme riches and extreme poverty. Then into the great capitalistic systems and monopolies to be found as towering structures in most lands, whether the capital is owned by the government or the municipality or by a handful of wealthy men or by the great labor unions, matters not. Little of it is yet spent in reality for the betterment of human living or for the inculcation of the values which will lead to right human relations. Okay, so far, you know, first the myriad of homes. And into great capitalistic systems and monopolies. Yes. So we just follow this and see where the money goes. And, you know, I think I'm just going to keep this in the keeps us in the green, you know, when we're dealing with humanity and money, keep it green. Then number three, into the churches and religious groups throughout the world. You know, the Catholic Church, for instance, and maybe some other groups in Protestantism have the third ray personality, even though the soul of these groups is more likely to be on the sixth ray. But for the Catholic Church, interestingly, the Church of Rome, the first ray. Here again, speaking in general terms and at the same time recognizing the existence of a small, spiritually minded minority, the money is deflected into the material aspect of the work, you know, the so-called edifice complex, building and building, rebuilding, not the humanistic need or humanistic orientation to meet human need. The money is dedicated, is deflected into the material aspect of the work, into the multiplying and preservation of ecclesiastical structures, into salaries and general overhead. Hardly like the Christians in the catacombs, is it? and only a percentage of it really goes into the teaching of the people, into a living demonstration of the fact of his return, for centuries, a definite doctrine of the church. So, reflected into the material aspect of the work. Another indictment. So many indictments by the Tibetan are not appreciated by those involved in, or the targets of the indictment. I mean, it can be the Jewish group, it can be the homosexuals, it can be the church, it can be Judaism in its orthodox sense. Well, it's really all of us, isn't it? We stand indicted. Now, that return has been anticipated down the ages and might have occurred ere now, had the churches and religious organizations everywhere done their duty. Well, the finger is pointing. And when it points, those at whom it points begin to squirm, or in a fit of pride, reject what is said. Or they say, hey, Alice Bailey wrote that, not the Tibetan. Which is foolish. You know, Alice said, if I did not take down all things as the Tibetan said them, he would immediately dispense with my services. Number four, into philanthropic, educational, and medical work. Now, this is good in a sense. Maybe it's rarely that it goes there first. All of this has been exceedingly good and greatly needed, and the debt of the world to the public-spirited men who have made these institutions possible is great indeed. Men and women, of course. All of this has been a step in the right direction and an expression of the divine will to good. It is, however, frequently money misused and misdirected, and the values developed have been largely institutional and concrete. They have been limited by the separative tenets of the donors or the religious prejudices of those who control the disbursement of the funds. In the quarreling over ideas, religious theories, and ideologies, the true assistance of the one humanity is overlooked. So even here, an indictment exists. We don't build into the soul, build into the triad. We don't value those things so much as we value that which is concrete. And this has to change with the cultivation of the mind, which should be the mind as it is in Christ. Tall order, but cannot be the usual, habitual, illusion condition, glamour condition, Maya conditioned, concrete approach. So that's where money goes. And let each of us examine the money we have and see if we can justify the place or the area to which it is directed. The fact remains that had the directing agencies through those whose hands the money in the world is channeled any vision of the spiritual realities of the one humanity and the one world, and had their objective been the stimulation of right human relations, this is the foundation, the mass of men everywhere would be responding to a vision very different from the present one. We would not be faced, as we are today, with the expenditures running into countless billions and now trillions, necessitated by the need to restore physically not only the physical bodies of countless millions of men, but entire cities, transportation systems, and centers responsible for the reorganization of human living. So we've committed grave errors here. Sometimes, you know, you begin to think that humanity is the erring kingdom. Master Moria speaks of the castle of errors, the ideas built at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong substance, by the wrong people, for the wrong purpose, etc. And he ends it all by saying, at length, one gets tired of errors. So somehow we have to instill a different vision. It's not only with no vision that people perish, with the wrong vision, they're going to go into the swamp and get stuck. So we are very responsible for inculcating the state of mind, which is needed. Equally, it can be said that if the spiritual values and the spiritual responsibilities attached to money, in large quantities or in small, and this we have to remember, because the old bugbear, well, what can I do with a dollar or two? If those responsibilities have been properly appreciated and taught in homes and schools, we would not have the appalling statistics of the money spent prior to the war in every country in the world, and spent today in the Western Hemisphere on candy, liquor, cigarettes, recreation, unnecessary clothes, and luxuries. These statistics run into hundreds of millions of dollars every year. It's got to be more now. A quota of this money necessitating the minimum of sacrifice would enable the disciples of the Christ and the new group of world servers to prepare the way for his coming and to educate the minds and hearts of men in every land in right human relations. There it is again. Right human relations repeated as an utter necessity held before our eyes so that we can really participate in this. So here's the way it should have been. I'll put it in blue, you know, deep blue. Just as DK says, somehow it seems that people just can't bring themselves to give. Money, as with all else in human living, has been tainted by selfishness and grabbed for selfish individual or national ends. Kind of wonder what all those super yachts out there are contributing to the upliftment of humanity as a whole. Well, we're told that in Atlantean days the luxury was even worse. One can hardly imagine. But people are so willing to sacrifice other people for their own self-aggrandizement. Yes, they do that. The ego, lower ego, is so demanding, so vampiristic, if I may say, sucking away the vitality which is meant to uplift the race as a whole. So it's been tainted by selfishness, grabbed for selfish individual and national ends. Of this, the World War 1914-45 to 45 is the proof. For although there was much talk of, quote, saving the world for democracy, close quote, and, quote, fighting a war to end war, the main motive was self-protection and self-preservation, the hope of gain, the satisfaction of ancient hatreds, and the regaining of territory. Well, DK sees behind the scenes, and many of us could have been deluded by these apparently more worthy motives, but were they real? Although there was much talk of saving the world for democracy and fighting a war to end war, the main motive was self-protection. You know, keeping the monarchies from being overthrown didn't work in Russia, did it? And self-preservation didn't work for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, did it? The hope of gain, the satisfaction of ancient hatreds, Turkey applying itself to Armenia, it didn't work. There. So the realities are other than we may self-consolingly imagine. The satisfaction of ancient hatreds, I was thinking of the Armenian genocide for which Turkey was responsible, the ancient hatreds. It's just the same old battle between Muslims and Christians. And maybe in the Crusades, the Christians thought the Muslims were unnecessary, and once the Muslim armies began to rise, they thought that the Christians were unnecessary. And it still goes on today, the massacres. The 2 years which have passed since the war have proved this to be the case. Well, you know, there was also Germany looking for Lebensraum, room to live, regardless of what it meant for the others who had habitually lived there. And then, of course, the Jewish group pushing the Palestinians off the land that they had occupied now for a long time. More Lebensraum, even, you know, since behind both groups, the same evil subjective group was at work. Aggressive expansion. Aggressive expansion. So the 2 years that have elapsed since the war have proved this to be so. The United Nations is occupied with rapacious demands on all sides, from all sides, with the angling of nations, you know, this is a third-rate manipulative maneuvering, with the angling of the nations for place and power, and for the possession of the natural resources of the earth, coal, oil, etc. Cornering the market, you know, it's a scorpionic thing to do. And humanity is ruled by Scorpio, the lower part of Scorpio too. Let Maya flourish and deception rule. And also with the underground activities of the great powers, you know, the secret police, the CIA, the fomenting revolution and seeking regime change and toppling those that are in power but are not among the preferred, because they counter the ambitions of those who care only for themselves or their own nation, and also the underground activities of the great powers and of the capitalists, which they all create, the underground activities. Well, friends, as sometimes happens, there are things that one must deal with. So, although this particular program maybe lasts, I don't know, an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half, something of that nature, I will have to call it right now. And after talking about the rapacious demands from all sides and the underground activities and the angling for power and place, we will come back and talk about the one humanity. So I will be back as soon as I can be. And meanwhile, I will call this particular program to an end. I was trying to find where I belong, however, you know. Page 626. So, almost there. Just a little bit of patience. 619 to page 626. And this is the 80th program. And it's about an hour and 20, something of that nature. And now I will bring this down to where it belongs. It's a little seventh-ray housekeeping here. And people like me do need it, you know? So, this is the end of program 80. And it's approximately 1 hour and so far about 20 minutes. And 619 to 626, whoop, little dyslexia there, 626, and this is the 14th. And we start with program number 81. Whenever I can start it, so I'll put my X's there, and 1 hour here, and XX. And it'll be from 626 to whatever it is. So thank you, everybody, for being here. And well, it's so practical, isn't it? You know, about how people are really behaving, even though the Great War should have taught us lessons about suffering, about the causes of war, about sharing, about underhandedness, about aggression, you know, all it should have taught us about the machinations of the personality. It should have. But apparently, The lesson was not sufficiently learned, so what will it be now? All right. So now we'll stop the recording. And thank you for being here. Lots of love, many blessings. And we will work a little later. Moon's in Aries today. Something has to come out of it. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.